We'll proceed next in the matter of People v. Kevin Michael Black, hearing first from Ms. Cotler. You may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning. Eileen Cotler on behalf of Appellant Kevin Black. May it please the Court. The United States Supreme Court has made it abundantly clear that any fact that increases the defendant's punishment beyond that authorized by jury verdict must be presented to the jury and proven beyond a reasonable doubt.
But in this case, didn't the jury make factual findings of force and violence?
The jury made factual findings as relating to probation that the act was committed by force, fear, duress, or menace. That is not quite the same as the aggravating factor set out in 4.42.
How is it different?
Which has great violence, duress, etc. There is a difference in California law between, say, by analogy, bodily injury and great bodily injury. So I'm unsure that the fact found by the jury would support the upper term or consecutive sentence. The bigger problem, or even assuming that it does, the question is if one fact alone is sufficient to get the defendant to the aggravated term. And appellant asserts that it is not.
There's a threshold issue that I would like you to address. According to the Attorney General, you have forfeited the issue of raising the question of the constitutionality of your client's sentence because of a failure to object in the trial court. What is your response to that?
Well, this case was post-Apprendi, but pre-Blakely. Blakely came out after the Court of Appeal had rendered a decision. Our position is, first, that this court can certainly consider without objection anything that goes to the substantial rights of the party. Second, any objection would have been futile because at the time Mr. Black was sentenced, there was certainly no mechanism to have aggravating factors tried to a jury. And for those reasons, we would ask the court to consider the issue now without the doctrine of waiver or forfeiture. The Attorney General has attempted to narrow Cunningham's ruling by relying on Osband. They assert that once a jury finds or a defendant admits an aggravating fact, the defendant is exposed to the upper term and a trial court may find all remaining aggravating facts by a preponderance of the evidence. There are several problems with this. First is that Osband never enunciated a substantive rule of law. In Osband, there were several aggravating factors, but the court relied on an element of offense to support the aggravated term. The Osband court only considered whether that error was harmless under state law. And the holding was that a single factor in aggravation suffices to support the upper term, and therefore there was no reasonable probability, i.e. the Watson standard, that a more favorable sentence would have been imposed absent the error. Secondly, allowing one Blakely compliant or Cunningham compliant factor to suffice would permit California's sentencing scheme to operate in a way that Cunningham never intended.
What is your response to the argument that here there were two aggravating circumstances that were established by means that were proper under Apprendi, Blakely, and Cunningham? You may recall that the jury found true the allegation that defendant had committed the crime of continuous sexual abuse by means of, and then we get into the statutory language, force, violence, duress, blah, blah, blah. As I recall, the jury made that determination pertaining to probation, but it is my understanding that this particular circumstance is also a proper circumstance for imposition of the upper term. Your view? Before I get to my second question.
Well, as I say, that goes to two things. They didn't find great violence is the factor set out in 4.421. But if it is proper, we are arguing that one factor alone is insufficient to subject the defendant to the upper term.
All right, then we get to the second circumstance. The trial court, at least as I recall, in imposing the upper term, also relied on defendant's prior record. And as I understand federal law at issue, this is quite permissible under the high court's decision in Blakely.
I tend to disagree, Your Honor. I think the history of Almendarez-Torres and subsequent cases revealed that the United States Supreme Court never intended to have the fact of a prior conviction be read so broadly.
So there is nothing in Blakely, and I'm going to ask that same question of the Attorney General. I'd like to hear from you. Your view is there is nothing in Blakely that says that the right to a jury trial does not apply to the fact of a prior conviction. Is that right?
No. I think the simple fact of a prior conviction is exempted by Almendarez-Torres and Blakely. Therefore, had the court said, I am applying the aggravated term because Mr. Black has suffered some theft-related offenses that may have been proper to do so. But the court never did that. What the trial court did was relied on the district attorney's statement in aggravation, and in that she had listed that his prior convictions were numerous or of increasing seriousness.
Well, let me ask you this. How can a jury be in a position to make a determination whether number of statutory enactments represent increased seriousness or violence? That may be a complex question even for a judge, but what does the jury have that would equip it to make that kind of determination?
Well, I think the jury has the same things that the judge has to make that determination.
Well, not legal training, certainly.
No.
And we're talking about
usually not
statutory interpretation in terms of the penal consequences under the law of various violations of different sections of the penal code and other codes.
But it isn't really a legal question. It is a factual question of whether the defendant's prior convictions are numerous or of increasing seriousness.
So can a jury determine whether second-degree burglary is more serious than receiving stolen property?
Well, perhaps we should trust them to do so.
By what standard? What would we tell them? Okay, now we're telling you, you have to make this determination as to what, whether or not these crimes are of increasing seriousness. Good luck to you in figuring that out. What would we tell them that would guide them in that determination?
Well, I think in some offenses, it would be fairly obvious
All right, if you go from drunk driving to robbery to murder, probably fairly straightforward, although there are variations on all those themes. And do we just kind of trust the jury to have a gut feeling that these are increasingly serious?
Well, I think one thing that we have to consider is if the crimes are so, appear to be so close in seriousness, if this is indeed a proper factor on which the district attorney should rely to present it to the jury.
But that doesn't answer my question. When we present it to the jury, what do we tell them so that they can, we can be confident that they're engaging in some kind of rational evaluation of whether or not they are of increasing seriousness?
I think we could define the crimes for them under statute and let them decide.
Isn't that's it? That's what makes them more serious? Kind of a gut feeling that receiving stolen property is probably less serious than grand theft, but if you have two or three grand thefts, then that's probably close enough? I mean, I'm trying to figure out, as a trial court, what do we tell the jury when we ask them to make this wanted determination that you're suggesting they should make?
I'm unsure that I can come up with a proper answer at this time.
Don't you think it would be pretty important to be able to answer that question before we start pronouncing new rules?
Well, I don't think this is a new rule. I think this is a rule that's required by the United States Supreme Court. That if, in fact, we require the jury to make factual determinations, that the U.S. Supreme Court requires them to do so. The thing is, I don't think that even with legal training, when you get crimes that are close in seriousness, that the trial judge is any better equipped than the jury to make those determinations.
Well, it does help if you have studied the penal code, what it provides, and what the respective punishments specified are for various offenses, doesn't it? But doesn't that equip a judge somewhat more than it equips a jury to make that determination?
Yes, and perhaps that's the answer. If we needed to tell the jury or instruct the jury of what the punishments were for.
Oh, okay. So now we're going to tell the jury, by all means, don't consider penalty when you're making your determination of whether or not the defendant is guilty. But let us just tell you what some of the penalties are for some of these crimes. But when you're trying to decide whether or not he did them, don't take that into account.
Well, I think it could be done in a bifurcated proceeding. Certainly, you know, that often happens when the jury is asked. Define prior.
All right, but say the defendant is found guilty of some sex offense, and the jury learns that he's got a prior robbery, which has a fairly substantial term of years. Isn't the jury going to be very concerned about what potential punishment might be imposed on him if they make these findings, and isn't that exactly the thing we tell them not to do?
I'm not sure that I understand.
Don't we, when we start laying out on the record for the jury potential penalties for offenses, it creates a great potential for mischief. Don't you agree? We don't usually do that.
No, we don't usually do that. But if it's done in a bifurcated proceeding, then the issue of innocence or guilt wouldn't be affected by that.
Right, but isn't there a temptation, for example, that a jury will think, well, we don't want to make these findings because then the penalty will be very high, particularly when we start telling them what the penalties are.
But isn't that true under the three strikes law or any other law that we ask the jury to make certain determinations?
We ask the jury to make determinations as to whether or not the strikes have been suffered. We don't go into great detail about the nature of punishment, as I recall.
Well, that's true, but after a while it gets to be pretty common knowledge of why.
So since everybody knows it anyway, we might as well throw over 100 years of precedent and start telling them.
Well, I think after the holdings of the United States Supreme Court, we're going to have no choice but to allow the jury to make this determination.
I'd like to take you back to your earlier argument just to explore the scope of it. If a jury, let's just say, made findings on six different matters that could qualify as aggravating factors, but in fact there were seven, and the judge recited seven items that he or she considered aggravating, would that, under your argument, cause there to be a reversible Cunningham error because there was one, there was a seventh one, factors that was not subject of a finding by the jury?
Well, I think you're asking a little bit different question. I think not. You're not asking me, if I'm correct, whether there was error. There was error because the court relied on a non-Blakely compliant factor. The question is whether, I think you're asking me whether it was prejudicial.
Well, I'm asking you both, really, yes.
And I think on the answer to that is if it can be determined from the record that the Blakely compliant factors were so overwhelming that we could say beyond a reasonable doubt that that is a sentence that the court would have imposed, then perhaps we can say that the error was not prejudicial. It does concern me somewhat, however, because in Cuenco, the United States Supreme Court at least left open the possibility that if a state had no mechanism on which to present these factors to the jury, that the error would never be harmless. And I think that is still an open question left by Requenco. I would like to return to the Osband factors with the court's permission. Another problem with allowing one factor, Blakely or Cunningham compliant factor, to suffice allows the California sentencing scheme to be administered in a way that I believe Cunningham never intended. The Cunningham court held that the jury, rather than the court, should find facts beyond a reasonable doubt that expose the defendant to the enhanced term. If we allow one factor to suffice, such would flip the Cunningham's ruling on its head. Third, this court attempted previously in Black to construe the holdings in Blakely and Booker quite narrowly without success. And I think by invalidating California's sentencing scheme, the Cunningham court indicated that their holding should be broadly applied. They related to Apprendi's bright line rule that all facts that permit a term in excess of the statutory minimum as defined must be submitted to a jury and proven beyond a reasonable doubt. And in raising the Osband argument, the Attorney General again attempts to narrow Cunningham's holding so that, in fact, it would apply to very few defendants. Many defendants have prior convictions, and under Almendarez-Torres, any defendant who suffered a prior conviction, no matter how minor, would lose his or her Sixth Amendment protection.
Well, it doesn't necessarily mean the judge would actually impose a high term. The defendant would be eligible for a high term, but that doesn't necessarily mean that he's going to get a high term.
That's true, but the question isn't whether the court has the discretion or chooses to exercise its discretion to impose the upper term. The question is really the defendant's Sixth and Fourteenth Amendment right to a jury trial and proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And if we, in fact, allow a prior conviction or one factor that the judge could choose, since the factors, the aggravating factors, are non-exclusive. In fact, this argument could really do away with Cunningham's holding.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Cutler. Your time is up, assuming you wish to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal. And we'll hear now from Mr. Daniels.
Good morning, Honors. May it please the Court. Lawrence Daniels for the people. Appellant's upper-term sentence complied with Cunningham because any one of the aggravating circumstances based either on appellant's recidivism or a fact actually found by the jury made the upper term available.
Let me start, though, with the threshold question. I think it was one that we would have to confront initially, and that is your argument that there was forfeiture of this issue, and that regardless of how that issue should be resolved on the merits, that the defendant has forfeited the issue by not raising it below. Is that
your
position? Well, let me ask you this. The standard that we apply in our the Santiago case is whether the we consider the state of the law as it would have appeared to competent and knowledgeable counsel at the time of trial. Now, let me ask you this, I guess to put it most bluntly, if this court and the court of the Supreme Court of several other states could not anticipate the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling, Cunningham, why should we assume that a reasonably competent trial lawyer should have done so?
Well, Your Honor, first of all, the U.S. Supreme Court ultimately found that Apprendi and Blakely applied to our system. And if California's system had come before the U.S. Supreme Court, before the Washington State system had in Blakely, presumably it would have been the same result there, despite what this court ultimately decided.
Well, we know that now, although obviously this court felt that there were distinctions between parameters of sentencing allowed judges in the state of Washington and what's allowed under our three stage sentencing process here. So we didn't anticipate this. Why should we say that the defendant's rights are forfeited because his counsel didn't anticipate something that this court didn't anticipate and that some other state Supreme Courts did not anticipate?
And because although some state Supreme Courts didn't, some did. For example, New Jersey Supreme Court
certainly
did.
Some did, but not all, and not this one. And so why do we put that heavy a burden on defense counsel?
Well, Your Honor, I think there's a difference in this type of doctrine when there is settled law against a defendant. And there certainly wasn't any settled law against defendant at the time this defendant's sentencing hearing. This court had never ruled under Apprendi whether an upper term sentence in general would violate the Sixth Amendment right to jury trial. So it goes back to the general policies of the forfeiture doctrine to begin with, that those of not surprising the trial court later with some new rule or new application of a rule, even if most lawyers would not have objected. It's clear that some did foresee this. You know, Blakely himself objected, ultimately obtained relief. The defendant in United States versus Cotton objected, failed to object, and the U.S. Supreme Court found that failure to constitute forfeiture, even though Apprendi itself hadn't been issued yet. In this case, we have a situation where there was Apprendi. It was the very doctrine by which all of the subsequent cases followed. So,
well, when Apprendi came down, let's take a look at the pertinent language that is important here. Apprendi said, any fact that increases the penalty for a crime beyond the prescribed statutory maximum must be submitted to a jury, blah, blah, blah. And at the time of defendant's trial, there was no California case that had interpreted this high court language as applying to anything other than the upper term. At the time Apprendi came down, it was widely assumed in California, which is pertinent since we have a defendant is being tried in California courts, it was widely assumed that the maximum term authorized by the jury's verdict was the upper term. Thus, one could make the argument, and in my view reasonably so, Blakely was an unforeseeable change in the law, and therefore under this particular circumstance, because what eventually came down from the High Court in Blakely was totally unforeseeable in California, it would be unfair and improper and impermissible to bar the defendant from now raising the issue.
Well, Your Honor, I do think that that Blakely was not entirely unforeseeable, although certainly that decision could have gone a different way, applying Apprendi. Blakely itself quoted Apprendi in defining the very rule about statutory maximum, that it was the maximum that could be imposed based solely on the facts reflected in the jury verdict. They cited, and I believe even quoted that in Ring.
Your office wasn't advising DAs that, this is coming down the pike, you better start submitting these items to juries, was it? Not at your zone meetings or otherwise, were you?
Certainly, we like others, did not foresee that this was going to happen. But that
you didn't have a clue until Blakely, I presume. But leaving that aside, since you may be running quickly out of time, I presume you have a backup argument that, assuming that you lose on the forfeiture issue, I gather that you see you still have a winning argument on the two aggravating circumstances that led the trial court to imposition of the upper term.
Yes, Your Honor. The court imposed the upper term based on several facts that complied with Cunningham. And each of these by itself authorized the upper term and allowed the trial court to find additional aggravating circumstances in the regular exercise of its discretion. In California, this court's made clear that only one aggravating circumstance is necessary to impose the upper term.
And how many do we have here, at least from your office's perspective, too? One pertaining to the jury finding that I articulated earlier, and I presume the other aggravating circumstance, the one pertaining to the prior record?
That's correct, Your Honor, and we've actually articulated three. Two facts actually found by the jury and one, but they're all based on the finding that Your Honor did articulate. One fact authorizing the upper term in this case is that appellant had prior convictions that were numerous or of increasing seriousness.
Has the High Court said that with respect to prior convictions, it would be permissible to do what the trial court in this case did? You may recall my question to opposing counsel, and I saw there was disagreement from opposing counsel as to whether or not the High Court in Blakely had specifically authorized this.
Well, the High Court in Blakely specifically reiterated the exception enunciated in the
Almendrez-Torres
case by saying other than the fact of a prior conviction. So they acknowledged the recidivist exception that Almendrez-Torres enunciated. The crime's sentence and nature are legal questions that are the basis for determining increasing seriousness. Thus, this court in People v. McGee and People v. Epps held that the seriousness of a prior conviction is a legal question that's covered by the exception.
If I understand your point about prior convictions, then all of that is outside the realm of the jury, whether there were prior convictions and whether they were of increasing seriousness.
Yes, Your Honor. Moreover, and numerousness also fits under the exception because it merely involves counting the priors and assessing this number. It doesn't involve fact-finding that goes beyond the fact.
So is it your argument that in this case we have no concern about that second factor that the court recited for imposing the upper sentence?
Yes, Your Honor. These facts, they fall within the exception because they're based on the defendant's prior conviction. They don't relate to the commission of the current offense, and they're really verifiable by a review of court records. And these are all the policies that the U.S. Supreme Court has stated in support of this exception.
So as I understand it, these prior convictions of increasing seriousness suffice to render the defendant eligible for the upper term?
Yes, Your Honor.
That being the case, must any other factor that the court recites have been found by the jury?
No, Your Honor. And it so happens that in this case there are multiple independent reasons. There were facts actually found by the jury, and they would independently support the upper term sentence. But this court could rule solely based in this case on the prior conviction finding alone that appellant's upper term sentence was authorized.
So it's your position, I just want to make sure, that if there is a legally sufficient basis for imposing, making the defendant eligible, whether it's the prior conviction exception from the jury fact-finding or it's a fact found by the jury, if the record shows that, it doesn't matter that the trial court would give as a reason something that the jury needed to find but hadn't found.
Yes, Your Honor. That kind of discretionary judicial fact-finding within the now authorized range is permissible. Once the trial court has made these findings about prior convictions or findings based on the facts actually found by the jury, the upper term now becomes the statutory maximum in California, because we know that that was all that was necessary to impose the upper term. Now
here, the with respect to the offense itself, the trial court referred to the nature and circumstances of the crime, which is a permissible basis under the California sentencing scheme. Does that rely, how is that tied into any factual finding by the jury?
Many of them don't. And many of them, or certainly many of them, are not directly match those found by the jury. But the Supreme Court's made clear in Booker that when a trial judge exercises his discretion to select a specific sentence within a defined range, the defendant has no right to a jury determination of the facts that the judge deems relevant. And that's what happens with these other factors.
So to touch on the point that Ms. Cocker made, or the question she raised, I assume it would be your position that it's not a question of harmless error, that there isn't error as long as the maximum punishment is justified by a jury finding, whether that's a particular one relied upon by the trial judge or not.
That's right, Your Honor. It's we now know that the U.S. Supreme Court's rule is very rigidly applied, and in looking at California law, it's very straightforward to see exactly when fact-finding is permissible and when it's impermissible. And it's permissible whenever to impose an upper term, whenever that upper term has become authorized under California law without the need for any additional.
It doesn't matter how many there are, does it? You know, if there are half a dozen and the judge, talks about some of them, but not perhaps one that the jury found. That's
correct, Your Honor, because at that point, the defendant has no legal right to a lesser sentence without any one of those many factors. So it's taken out of the realm of the Sixth Amendment and back to the just permissible judicial discretion that sentencing courts have always exercised within a permissible range.
Did you hear opposing counsel's response to my question regarding the jury's factual findings of force and violence?
Yes.
What is your response?
Your Honor.
That there was no great bodily injury and did not support the aggravation.
Well, Your Honor, those specific facts that counsel is referring to, we're not relying on the finding of great bodily injury. Specifically, the two factors are, number one, that the trial court's finding that appellant threatened the victim, and that was inherent in the jury's special finding that Justice Kennard referred to earlier, that appellant used duress, menace, and fear of immediate and unlawful bodily injury in committing the crime. There's really no way that you could commit a crime with duress, menace, and fear of immediate and unlawful bodily injury without threatening the victim. So that was necessarily found by the jury. A second aggravating factor that we're relying on is that appellant used force, the trial court's finding that appellant used force in having sexual intercourse with the minor victim on numerous occasions. And that was inherent in the jury's verdict and findings that appellant used force in the special allegation in committing this crime of continuous sexual abuse on a child And then there was the special finding that they also made that it was by means of sexual intercourse on at least three occasions. So those various findings put together also supported that particular aggravating circumstance finding. And again, any one of these findings, whether it's one of those two, whether it's the prior conviction finding, any one of those would have supported the upper term in this case.
Does the jury's finding have to track word for word and exactly the language of a particular aggravating factor relied upon by the judge or not?
No, I don't believe it needs to track it, Your Honor. What's important is that it is necessarily found within that finding. It's necessarily within that finding. So I do. There's no requirement that the words be exactly the same. Appellant's consecutive sentence in this case, one of the other issues raised in this court, it was proper for two independent reasons, and this court did correctly find in its earlier opinion in Black that consecutive sentencing does not implicate the Sixth Amendment. The right to jury trial does not impact how sentences on multiple crimes run together. Once the statutory maximum for a crime has been determined, there are not suddenly two statutory maxima, one for the crime and one for multiple crimes. In fact, as this court noted, Apprendi called the sentence on another count irrelevant to determining the statutory maximum.
Are you aware of any published decision anywhere in the United States that has applied this line of cases to the question of consecutive sentencing?
No, Your Honor.
They've all rejected it, those that have been confronted with it, haven't they?
Of the federal courts?
Yeah.
Yes, all the federal circuit courts addressing this issue have for this same reason, rejected the application of consecutive sentences.
There aren't any state court rulings that have accepted that argument that it applies.
Well, there are two state Supreme Court rulings that did find that under the peculiar facts of their sentencing scheme systems that the consecutive sentencing was violated. And they were Washington State and Ohio. And in both of those states, unlike California, there was this strong presumption of a concurrent term. And the explicit statement in the statute that the jury had to find particular facts to impose a consecutive term.
But nothing that would be on all fours with the type of scheme we have here in California. There hasn't been any holding, has there?
That's correct, Your Honor. Nothing in terms of our system. And in fact, in support of response position that facts aren't required to impose a consecutive sentence in California, I would like to cite to one Court of Appeal case, People versus Forbes. And in that case, the Court of Appeal held that the court's desire that the defendant serve his full deserved time was a proper basis for ordering the terms run consecutively. So that was really a policy judgment in the exercise of the court's broad discretion and not a factual finding. In People versus Jimenez, which was a case that did come 2 years before the DSL in 1975, but in a situation where it's our position that the law really hasn't changed as to consecutive sentencing, this court also upheld the trial court's broad discretion to select a consecutive sentence because the defendant refused to accept the terms of probation. This court found that the trial court could reasonably find that the consecutive sentence was necessary to further the legitimate sentencing objectives of rehabilitation and protection of the public.
Counsel, could you respond to your opposing counsel's concern that in any case involving a recidivist, that the court would be free to impose and then might impose a high-term sentence, and that would really eliminate any distinction between individual defendants?
Well, Your Honor, we are simply talking about really past cases, and as our position and this court may delve into the remedy in this case or in Hubert Sandoval, future cases is our position that that wouldn't be the case. But we're not trying to find at this point what the best system is when we're looking at these pipeline cases and what's the fairest system. We're simply looking, does it comply with the Sixth Amendment under Cunningham? So, in many or most situations, these defendants will have a prior criminal history, and then that could be permissibly used. support the upper term.
Once you have a case where, under your argument, you do have a legitimate factor for imposition of the higher term, it would be inappropriate, would it not, for the sentencing judge to rely on other factors that may have been rejected by the jury? Factual?
Well, Your Honor, no, it's our position that under Blakely, there's no requirement that judge disregard, even though it's not present in our case, there's no requirement that they disregard facts that the jury did not find or found not to be true, because that would be a higher beyond a reasonable doubt standard than would be required. Again, once the upper term becomes authorized, then even in that situation, the trial court could.
We don't have that issue here, do we?
That's correct. That is certainly not present in this court. Right, would not have to reach that issue in this case.
Well, what would to follow up on Justice Baxter's question, what would happen if there wasn't any prior record involved here? And the question was, you know, use of force or violence. And the jury had come up with a not true finding from the special allegation. And the judge said, well, I'm relying upon the fact that I find that there was violence or threat.
In a situation where there is not a single aggravating circumstance that complies with Cunningham, either under recidivism section exception or because there was no facts found by the jury, then in that situation, yes, it would appear there would be Cunningham error because there would be no Cunningham example of applying factors. This court would have to look to doctrines such as forfeiture and harmless error to determine if the case should be affirmed or not. Cunningham.
Well, just to make sure I understand, hypothetically, if there was a great bodily injury enhancement alleged that the jury found not true, in other words, is it your position that as one of the additional factors in aggravation, the judge could rely on great bodily injury?
As one of the additional factors, yes, Your Honor. But not as the sole factor.
Even though it contradicts jury finding.
Yes, it is. That is our position. Because there's two different standards, and the jury may not have found it beyond a reasonable doubt, but it doesn't mean that the judge couldn't find it by preponderance. Your Honor, I'd briefly turn to the remedy in this case. Not in this case, excuse me, but in many of the other cases that would need to be remanded. Reforming the statute to eliminate the middle term presumption is the remedy that clearly effectuates the legislature's policy judgments. It is also the one that the legislature clearly would have preferred and has preferred in its responsive amendment to Cunningham. The legislature intended for proportionality and uniformity by means of legislatively prescribed punishment with specified judicial discretion, and the legislature now has promptly and overwhelmingly passed SB 40, urgency legislation implementing the broad discretion approach. This is compelling evidence that the prior legislature would also have preferred this option to the jury trial on aggravating circumstances option. Given the legislature's determination, it would be inconsistent for this court to impose on trial courts the burden of implementing a judicially designed aggravating factor jury trial system that would be unique to those defendants whose crimes were committed before SB 40. It is our position then that this reformation should apply to sentencings based on any crime committed before SB 40's effective date. The Supreme Court in Booker applied to all sentencing hearings its remedy in the federal system of eliminating the requirement of additional judicial fact-finding to increase a sentence. It should be assumed that the high court would not order lower courts to engage in unconstitutional conduct, so there should not be any construction of a due process violation from this. Furthermore, the federal courts have uniformly rejected due process challenges to applying these judicially made changes to sentencing where the crimes were committed before these changes. Legislature has preserved our sentencing system to the greatest possible extent with SB 40. Seeking a remedy for the numerous cases not covered by SB 40, this court should closely effectuate the same intent by reforming the statute in the same manner, continuing to allow broad discretion in the statutory range, but without any requirement of additional judicial fact-finding. In appellant's case, however, this court should find his upper term and consecutive sentence constitutional. There are no further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Daniels. Ms. Carter, you may argue in rebuttal.
Could you start by giving us your impression of how SB 40 should inform our decision here?
Assuming that SB 40 is constitutional, there is certainly, it is silent to the to retroactivity, and therefore appellant would submit that it would have to be applied prospectively. So I don't think that it has any relevance except to show what the congressional intent would now be. Furthermore, SB 40 was really a quick fix solution. It's only going to be in effect for 2 years while the legislature figures out what it really wants to do. And therefore, I don't think the court can rely on it as what the legislature's ultimate decision will be. We've argued in our brief that there would be a violation of due process to deny criminal defendants who were sentenced post-Apprendi and before SB 40 was enacted to deny them their right, their Sixth and Fourteenth Amendment rights to a jury trial and proof beyond a reasonable doubt. I'm somewhat also concerned on the one-factor issue, especially as related to the upper term, because appellant submits that one factor, except in the unusual case, does not authorize the upper term. Both by statute and by rules of court, the judge is commanded to determine all aggravating factors and then balance the aggravating and mitigating factors, and thereafter determine whether that balance authorizes the upper term.
Does that involve the kind of fact-finding process that is struck down by Cunningham?
I think Cunningham requires the jury to find all aggravating facts beyond a reasonable doubt. Those facts must be both pleaded and proved to the jury. Once the jury has made that determination, I think the judge would then have the authority to balance them and the discretion to decide whether or not to sentence the defendant to the aggravated term.
Now, in this case, the jury, as has been said, made the finding that the crime was committed by means of force, violence, duress, menace, fear of immediate and unlawful bodily injury. I believe the argument has been made that this satisfies the aggravating circumstance of great bodily harm and threat of great bodily harm and great violence. Is that correct, that that argument has been made, that these two are equivalent? And your response to that is what, to refresh my recollection?
I didn't think a jury finding of violence, etc., will automatically satisfy the requirement that it be great violence, etc. The threats that – it's somewhat confusing in this case because it was pled in the disjunctive or find violence, etc., or threats, etc. in the jury finding itself, they used and rather than or. So it's a little bit difficult to determine what the jury actually found. In fact, the only threats in this case were the threats not to tell. There were no threats of immediate or future bodily injury.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Gottlieb. Your time is up. Thank you, Mr. Daniels. The matter stands submitted.